Popsal plavbu do Evropy se syrskými uprchlíky nebo utrpení nigerijských dívek unesených islamisty z Boko Haram. V roce 2014 unesli 276 školaček z odlehlé vesnice Chibok. Reportér německého týdeníku Die Zeit, Wolfgang Bauer. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
The Boko Haram released some 80 girls kidnapped from Chibok school earlier in May. What happened exactly?
What happened to them? As far as we know, because girls are still kept in isolation by the Nigerian government, they are now in Abuja, the capital of Nigeria, and they will be, as all the other women who ended up in the hands of the Nigerian government, will be kept for several months in so-called de-radicalization camps.
And why were they released right now?
They were released because Boko Haram is now in a very difficult military situation, so they were released for a prisoner exchange. The Nigerian government got the Chibok, 82 of the Chibok girls, while Boko Haram obviously got food and some high-ranking prisoners in exchange. It was a deal.
Is it even possible to tell how many women and children are now still in the hands of Boko Haram?
That's, in my regards, absolutely impossible, because most of the women who are kidnapped are never registered by anybody. The state governmental structures are not present in the area where Boko Haram is operating. Used not to be present already before the Boko Haram time, so actually nobody knows how many people are really kidnapped and how many people are currently being kidnapped. I mean, this phenomenon didn't stop one month ago or 1 year ago. Still, every week I get news from my contacts on the ground about four women who were kidnapped in this village and a group of other women who were kidnapped in a neighboring village. This problem goes on.
I'd like to go back to what you mentioned, these de-radicalization camps. Probably some people do not know what they are and why they were actually set up. Could you go a bit deeper on that?
Yeah, if the women are being released by Boko Haram or just get freed from Boko Haram, the society is reacting quite hostile towards those victims, because they can't be sure if the women were not brainwashed by Boko Haram. The most lethal weapon of Boko Haram right now are kidnapped women and girls. That was also a problem in our work, how to approach those women without endangering us and anybody else. Boko Haram is using some of these women and girls as suicidal attackers. They force them or they brainwash some of them, attach explosive belts to them, and sending them to some crowded places like bus stations or markets, squares, where those women and girls, blow themselves up with dozens and dozens of victims. That's one of the reasons why the society is has decided to treat them carefully. For the victims, it's of course incredible hard and cruel, and so that's a reason why they try to avoid any contacts with the governments if it's possible. So they just go back to their villages. The others, they end up in the camps. They are kept there for months or years without any family contacts, so they are still in captivity actually. They get interrogated by governmental agents. They want to know more about the Islamic sect. And they want to make sure that those women are not presenting a danger
to society. How much time does it take?
Months and years, nobody knows. So far, also last year, some women were released from Boko Haram, and they are still in those camps.
We were actually speaking about these suicidal attacks that they are used for. We know that they are never kidnapped for ransom. Could you explain the other motivations of such kidnappings?
They not only kidnap women and girls, they also kidnap boys. The system of Boko Haram is one of the bases is to have slavery again in the society, and to build up a new Islamistic modern society in their perception, and they want to turn the women into Islamists themselves. They want to have the women as sex slaves, the young women, to produce new babies together with Boko Haram fighters, so those new babies could also rise in the philosophy of Boko Haram, boys, you know, as born into fighters, and the girls again into women producing new fighters for the sect. And the older women are being kidnapped as labor slaves, doing the cooking and the household chores for the Boko Haram sect. And the young boys, they take for training camps where they learn how to fight. The older boys mostly are being killed once the sect is raiding a village.
When you're speaking about this ambition of having children with these women, have you ever encountered a case of a true love story, maybe? Or is it absolutely excluded from your point of view?
You know, towards me, the women would be careful to mention, you know, anything love-related and with a Boko Haram fighter, because this information would again endanger them. But, you know, there are 10,000s of women and girls who were kidnapped, and for sure there are also some relationships what started as forced marriages and ended up with a deeper human relationship. Life is complicated and emotions are too. And for sure you know about the Stockholm or Helsinki syndrome.
That's why I was asking.
Once you're taken by your kidnapper, you, in order to survive mentally, you develop, of course, a deeper emotional relationship to your kidnapper. And you end up entangled emotionally with your kidnapper, and your kidnapper is granting you some freedoms, you know, some privileges. For that reason, you need to be nice to the kidnapper, and then he is somehow nice to you, and that in the end, after so many months, if you're still a young person, it end up to be very complicated.
So you can imagine that such a thing would happen, a true feeling, both sides.
Absolutely, but most of the women I met, they expressed deep hatred and cried and really suffered under the memories they had about the time with Boko Haram. Also, you know, 12 or 13 years old girls, they didn't express much sympathies towards the former jailers.
What is sure is that you interviewed a really tremendous number of these victims, female victims of kidnappings. How hard was it for you to establish this trusting relationship between you and these interviewed women and girls, and how hard was it to persuade them to speak openly about what they lived, actually?
We had the fortune to meet local colleagues, reporters from important Nigerian newspapers who had family members in those villages which were raided from Boko Haram.
And so that helped you find them, actually?
That helped us finding them, and helped also to build up trust, because the intermediators, they were family members from some of the women, which is very important in this culture for trust building. And in the beginning, I asked a female colleague from Sweden who did some interviews before with those women, and I asked her, can I do it as a man, as a white man, to conduct those talks? And she said, you know, either you are a female or you're male, you're white, you come from far away places, and she called us the third gender as a white person, coming from far away to a woman coming from such villages in the northeastern part of Nigeria. And very important for us was to have a lot of time. I spent one day only on the introduction, with asking the women to describe me, the daily life routine in the village, in the family. We were debating the very earliest childhood memories, and only on the second day we touched, you know, the more cruel aspects of their life, the day of the kidnapping and what the Boko Haram sect really meant for the kidnapped women. So after one day we were, you know, we laughed a lot, we joked a lot, they joked about their husbands the real husbands from the old times. They joked about their fathers and allowed me also to understand who they really were. They are not only victims. They are much more than the suffering. You know, they are like us with a lot of complexity in their personalities, and they understood that I'm not interested in exploiting the suffering, and so that helped much to open up.
How many of those former husbands you were now mentioning are still alive? Because we usually hear that women are kidnapped, girls are kidnapped, boys are kidnapped, but adult men are often just killed on the spot.
Yeah, that's right. Most of them are killed or they escaped and they are not in touch anymore with the former families.
So who do these women, when they get back to?
To where they get back to? To the old villages and to the old extended family members.
How is this returning home for them then? Are they trusted on what they are describing, all these horrors, or do they prefer not to speak about it? How do their first days and weeks look like when they come back from these horror situations?
They're not trusted at all, and even in the tiniest village you have a split of the society. One fraction of the village had the fortune not to be kidnapped, so they were able to run away. The other one was kidnapped, and between those two parts of the village you have a deep gap of mistrust. They are very afraid of each other and get a lot of threats, especially when they got a baby from a Boko Haram fighter, especially when this baby is a male one. And then the rest of the village is very suspicious on if this baby will one day turn again into an fighter with a very dangerous philosophy in its mind and will take revenge on the rest of the village. That's the reason why those women prefer to live very low profile in the village, and why the suffering didn't stop by the release from Boko Haram. It still goes on.
Well, speaking of the suffering, these women and girls really describe incredibly cruel things such as hunger, thirst, beatings, rapes, beheadings, forced marriage, etc. You've talked about them yourselves. Have you ever encountered a greater horror in your reporting career at all? Is this comparable to anything else?
Hardly. I mean, they lived for sometimes 2 years in the hands of those people who were the torturers, and they were forced, you know, to sleep with men they just have seen decapitating other prisoners, and they came, you know, with a bloody hands back to the women and said, once you try again to run away from me, the same will happen to you by my own hands. I wonder, you know, how this generation, it's a whole generation of women, will perform in the future. What kind of society will be the outcome?
What's your guess?
It's difficult to say. It's also the question if the murdering, the raping and the abuses will stop. Boko Haram is still in the bushes. They are not defeated by all means. As long as the situation on the ground is so cruel that people try to get into touch with the Boko Haram sect and see in the sect as an alternative to the governmental forces, this problem will not be over soon. Still we have the killing in the villages conducted by the militias. The militias formed as a force, the only force very often, fighting Boko Haram. And the places abandoned by Boko Haram are now occupied more or less by those so-called militias, these popular forces. Mafia guys, more or less. The only and they randomly kill and abuse people, and I don't know who is more cruel, Boko Haram or those militias.
So you are now speaking of the partial retreat of the Boko Haram, because at one point they were controlling approximately 1/5 of the Nigerian territory. What is the situation now, if we're speaking about, you know, geopolitical percentage?
Situation right now, as I oversee it, is that they lost the major cities and the major villages. They don't control the tarmac roads, the major national roads, but they are very influential still in the settlements, in the harems, and in the small villages in the bush. So, for the majority of the population, it's still very dangerous to live in this area. Boko Haram is also active in Cameroon and all the neighboring countries, and is exploiting the flaws, the weakness of each government, you know, in their territory. And as long as the problems are not solved, Boko Haram can show up anytime again. And recently, Amnesty International published satellite photos and has shown an incredible degree of destruction caused by the fight against Boko Haram, caused by Nigerian forces.
I'd just like to add to this that the group had ties to Al-Qaeda. Now it is somehow linked to the Islamic State. How does this cooperation look like on the ground?
That's not known. When Boko Haram was on the peak of the military successes, obviously there was a frequent exchange of money and also personnel. The women who were kidnapped told us they have seen white people, even white jihadists, in the ranks of Boko Haram, working as technicians, experts, fixing the Russian tanks they conquered by then. They had Arab-speaking nurses and doctors. Boko Haram was fighting with Al-Qaeda in Mali and was still fighting, by the end of last year in Sirte, a town where I have been to in Libya, the town where Gaddafi was killed, and Boko Haram on the side with the Islamic State was able to control their 250 kilometers of the coastline of the Mediterranean Sea, just opposite of Italy. So they are, you know, they regroup at the moment. That's my impression. They are under heavy military pressure right now, but very soon, I'm afraid, the regional powers will lose their focus, and then again, the Islamists in the name of Boko Haram or a different name will show up again.
Well, speaking of that, region wars and jihadi terror have been among key reasons behind massive migration from Africa and the Middle East to Europe in recent years. Would you agree that much of what you cover, that is to say the plight of Boko Haram victims or Syrian refugees crossing the sea to Europe, are actually just bits of one big story?
Yeah, there are several stories, but they're interrelated. The main topic is not so much the Islamism, the main topic is the collapse of the colonial states. You know, we witness now...
Former colonial states.
Yeah, former colonial states, but created by colonial powers like Nigeria, like Mali, like Niger, all those countries in the Sahel zone, or like Syria was also created by colonial powers, by the French and the British. And they have forced parts of the population or different tribes in one state, tribes who were fighting each other since centuries, and out of a sudden the British and the And the French decided they need to live peacefully in one state, and that worked for a while with a iron fist dictator on top of it. But iron fist dictator only ends up in a bloody civil war, and now one state by one is collapsing, and this vacuum is being exploited by all kind of groups, and the Islamist groups are now in the lead of those groups, trying to get an alternative concept to the people. And that's the biggest danger for us in Europe, that we see dozens of states collapsing and being destabilized by civil wars, by Islamist sects as Boko Haram, and then the people who have a little bit of money, of course, and who don't see any perspective for the near future, they decide to go.
Which leads me to the following question, which is, how big is the business of refugees smuggling across the sea to Europe? How does it work?
It works like a travel agency. I mean, I've seen it plenty of times. I did a book on this topic, as you know. You go in Afghanistan, for example, you go to a travel agent, real and official travel agent. You ask him for the smugglers, and he will sell you the tickets.
How expensive are they?
It depends very much how dangerous and how frequent this route is used, the offering. But we ourselves, 3 years ago in Egypt, when we were doing this report on migration as undercover refugees, we needed to pay $3,000, for example, each. But you also can end up with $8,000. It depends on your budget and on the risk you're willing to take.
Yes, it can also end with a death experience, as we've seen in some cases. Were you frightened when you took this boat, when you were accompanying all these refugees?
Oh, sure. My heart was beating as hell. I can tell you the moment when we really entered the boat, when we left the beach in Egypt, and we needed to almost swim to the boat. And once I found myself on deck of the boat, my circulation was almost collapsing. So I needed really.
Did you regret being there? At some point.
No, I didn't regret it, because I felt it so necessary that we as journalists try to look behind the scenes, what's really happening. Formal interviews leave me very rarely satisfied, and I understood it's really necessary to see what's happening on those boats transporting 100,000 of people to Europe. And again, it's not a very individual experience, it's an experience of a whole generation of Syrians and North Africans right now. And we need to understand this experience to get along with those people once they ended up in Europe.
You were actually following their fate on the boats with Czech photographer Stanislav Krupaš. Are you still now in contact with these people? Do you know what they do now, whether they managed to integrate somehow, or what their situation is currently in these days?
We are still in touch with everybody, with all the living. Some of them died since the main family we accompanied is now in Frankfurt. They have got granted asylum. That's Anas, and he has three wonderful daughters. They are all fluent now in German, while he himself is struggling with the language, especially also his wife. So they, the older the people get, they struggle to adapt to our realities, while the young ladies, they really swim as fishes in the water, and they will be an big enrichment for our society very soon, or they already are. Other friends ended up in Sweden, and some of them have already jobs in restaurants and pay their taxes to the Swedish government. Others still have a hard time to cope with the situation. It depends very much on the temper.
That sounds pretty much like normal life. How do you manage to get back to your, let's say, so-called normal life after all these experiences in war zones that some people may call hell?
Somehow I managed to get some, you know, a psychological mindset which protects me somehow against furthermost extreme impressions. I think every nurse working in a hospital or elder home here in Prague, or a doctor on an intensive care station is facing every day much more extreme impressions than I do. And all those professions need to acquire a mindset which allows you to keep going, and at the same time you need to be transparent to perceive the emotion of the others and the suffering, what it really means. And it's a thin line, and so far I think I'm doing somehow good in getting along with it. Wolfgang. But it's a daily challenge, of course.
Of course. Wolfgang Bauer, thank you very much for this interview, for being on the other side. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your interest.